Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
We are here with an extra episode for you this week, and please be warned, sirens going off in the distance. This episode contains spoilers. Spoilers through the end of season 7 of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. In this episode, we sit down to have a more in-depth conversation with Natalie Muskin-Press, who you met here in our buffering verse when she did a segment in our episode for Tabula Rasa.
Yes, we will be, as you probably have guessed, taking a deeper look at Willow's arc with her use of magic in this season. There is a ton to be said, and there's no way for us to say all of it, even in the span of one complete episode. But since season 6 digs into some really massive themes, we want to do our best to create some space for more conversation than we're able to have within the episodic discussions themselves. A little information for you on Natalie. She is a licensed clinical addictions counselor who's been working in higher education for the last decade. And before that, she spent 3 years working in her community, providing intensive outpatient treatment to adults and adolescents and running a residential recovery home for women. It's also really important for us to note that Natalie works within a harm reduction framework with a focus on prevention, intervention, and education.
Our hope is to bring you a few of these very focused, thematic episodes this season, and we want to thank our patrons who have made it possible for us to produce large conversations in many ways over the past year. Thank you so much for your support of this space. In conjunction with this episode, and each of our larger thematic episodes this season, we will also be encouraging our listeners to donate, if they are able, to an organization doing work in this field. Natalie has recommended the organization Project Neighbors and has asked our listenership to specifically send funds toward the solar conversion project for their housing. Project Neighbors is an Indiana-based organization that works to strengthen the community by addressing issues of race, class, and poverty, striving to create healthy families and neighborhoods where diversity of all kinds is welcomed and cherished. You can learn more about their work and donate at projectneighbors.org.
Yes, and we are doing a pretty awesome giveaway of Buffy gifts, many of which have been provided by a listener, Jenna. Thank you. One of these gifts that Jenna has and is going to send out is an authenticated signed Buffy the Vampire Slayer cast photo. It rules. If you're able to donate, head on over to bufferingthevampireslayer.com/projectneighbors and let us know that you contributed. Filling out that form will enter you into the giveaway, and there'll be more information on our socials, of course. Or you can opt out of the giveaway if you just want to let us know that you donated. We love to kind of, you know, find out what our buffering community is able to do together. So go on over there. Let us know if you're able to donate. Again, projectneighbors.org to send that donation specifically to the solar project. You can see that on the little drop down on the site. And then if you want to be entered to win something very fun, you can fill out that form at bufferingthevampireslayer.com/projectneighbors.
And one more reminder that this episode's conversation will include spoilers through the end of Buffy season 7. It will also contain conversations on themes of substance use, the prison industrial complex, sex work, and mental health.
All right, let us do this thing.
Hello, and welcome to Buffering the Vampire Slayer, a podcast where we are usually discussing the entire series of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, one episode at a time, spoiler-free, but not today. Not today!
You're right, Jenny. We are not talking about one episode, and this is surely not spoiler-free. We're talking about any damn episode we want, as we're ready to talk about them, and full of spoilers, and we're here with Natalie. And you might remember Natalie from a few episodes ago when we talked a little bit about Willow's arc. We were safe in that space from spoilers. We are not anymore. Hello, Natalie.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
Listen, literally anytime. Here. Anytime.
Stop. I'm going to just start crashing your Zooms. Yeah. Is he still alive?
Yeah. It is just one link that Jenny and I use every time. So if we give it to you once, you could just see if we're in there.
Just randomly.
Nope.
What are you guys talking about?
So we've talked a little bit moving into season six about some big themes that we're going to be attempting to unpack here. And today's episode is us digging into Willow and Willow's arc with the misuse of magic and what magic is used to parallel and how that's done well or maybe not so well. As we go into big topics like this, right, it's not on anyone's singular shoulders to do and say all the things. So I just want to acknowledge that as much as, this conversation is so important, you can't say everything and do everything. And, we're going to do our best to talk about things that have come up in our prep for this episode. But, this isn't the last episode of Buffering the Vampire Slayer, God willing. So we're happy to continue the conversation. And before we also start talking about Willow specifically and Buffy specifically, for those of us, myself included, who aren't as familiar, and I know this is a changing landscape, we're going to date ourselves in 10 years, we're going to come back and say, oh no, what have we done here? But for now, words like misuse versus abuse, or referring to somebody as an addict versus, like, I would love to just get a bird's eye view of some of the terminology you might be using today.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll generally say someone who may or may not be misusing substances, right? Because, like, I'm reluctant, one, to diagnose in any way, shape, or form, and misuse does not have anything to do even with a potential diagnosis. You'll hear physical dependence, right? Which could be something just related to how your body is reacting to a substance versus someone saying you're an alcoholic, right? Which has a completely different, framework, but it's also something that's out there. And it's even something, like I said, I've been working in this field for a while and I catch myself, because when I came out, it was like, you have to say you're an alcoholic, you have to say you're an addict. And then if someone at all came into it and was like, no, we were like, oh, that's your denial talking, right? Mm-hmm. And never once given that opportunity to be like, no, that's you rejecting the fact that we're trying to tell you, in order to be taken seriously at trying to help yourself, you have to accept this label right off the bat, yeah. Right? Here we are. So, I know some stuff will still occasionally slip out because that's the words that have been in our head for so long and been in, our mouths for so long. But I tend to just go with if someone may or may not be misusing substance, or mm-hmm. if they are misusing substances, that tends to be when I'm trying to talk about what I consider use that maybe isn't healthy for them in that moment.
It just pings in my brain how much we all so desperately cling to binaries, yes. Outside of this particular mm-hmm. conversation, you either are this thing or you are not this thing. And then there's just no flexibility in that conversation.
Yeah. And, I think one thing is because substance misuse, substance issues, however you want to say it, have been relegated to this little, dark, seedy corner of the healthcare, even not even the healthcare industry. People were only really offered this one type of treatment, and it was really rooted in self-help stuff. And so what would happen is that would work for some people. And so then those people were like, it worked for me. And so then they became, which good for them, right? For me, I'm what helps, right? If it helps you, perfect. Mm-hmm. But then they populated a lot of the more substance abuse treatment situations. And so then you have housing that you have to be in AA and NA and you have to do the steps, right? There's no ability to be in recovery that doesn't, mm-hmm. Or there'll be people who they went to jail and that's what got them, sober. And that's what put them on the path. So they feel like, no, maybe you need to go to jail mm-hmm. to get that experience. And because you were either recovered through this path or you weren't, there was nobody to really push back and say, like, why aren't there more paths?
Right.
You know, this like really rigid, this is the way. And we have all these people who can tell you it's the way because it worked for them, even though we were definitely not helping people at any level that would be considered successful for a lot of other health areas. We want to give the people time to get to where they need to be, but a lot of the treatment options we have are so rigid. And so this way or no way, you're giving people an ultimatum, right? Like, and it could get really bad and frustrating and horrible and all of those things.
Well, before we turn the corner into the land of Sunnydale, is there anything else that you want to say up at the top, framing-wise, or do you think that we are set up to dive into all things Willow Rosenberg?
No, I just think there's going to be times when I feel like it speaks really well, and there's going to be times where I'm going to be frustrated. The storytelling choices that they made, I think, are different than like whether or not those individual moments they choose to show for her are true for someone or not. Like, it's not about, this isn't how it looks. It's more like, why did they choose to show it this way? And was that, is that helpful, you know, or did that reinforce like this very, did they do it in a way that reinforces stigma, even if they were honoring how it felt for some people, you know?
Yeah, and I think that that's really, you know, that's why we're having the conversation, is to look at this story with you, because Jenny and I can only do so much in looking at this. And, you know, our experience here is notably limited. So I suppose we should journey forth and start really with Willow and Willow's journey. And I say that because we're going to look at, outside of just Willow and the way that this show tells Willow's story, we're going to look at Rack, and I think we're going to talk a little bit about Amy, and certainly Tara, the Scoobies, Giles. You know, we'll hit some of these things, but we can start with Willow.
Natalie, as the anointed expert among us, in broad strokes, if we want to start kind of like backed way out, what's your observation, or what are your observations about what's working here and what's not?
So I think what works here, right, is the underlying reasons between why Willow makes some of the choices she makes. So I think like we all met Willow, right, drinking out of the water fountain in her lovely outfit, and like, she was
from Sears,
like, you know, and like that, looking back, her outfits weren't that bad.
No, Cordelia was,
they got actually worse.
True.
They really have. Like,
yeah, what is Willow's wardrobe a metaphor for? I actually joke, but I know we are going to talk about that.
Yes. No, I had a, it was like, bah, like popped into my head when I'm like, man, that's a lot of Willow stomach. And then I was like, but you know, she's always been insecure and, but wanting to help and just having like this earnestness about her. And I think like, even like, you know, and we, when she got with Oz, right, we all love Oz, but like there was also this like, oh, good for Willow, like Willow, there's always been this like little like sweetness around Willow that we want her to have good things, because we almost kind of, you know, like we bought into this idea that like she's sweet and she's kind and she's too nice for this world. And, you know, let's make Willow cry if we want to make people feel bad. And then she gets to be kind of like powerful, and she gets to be her own person, and she gets to grow, and like she gets to, you know, like explore her identity and do all of these cool things that we were like super excited for Willow. But like, that's still like all that other stuff, all those insecurities and things are still right there. And I think that, you know, they loved to explore Xander's insecurities at the beginning for like obvious reasons, some that have become even more obvious now, like in light. But like Willow, I think we always just assume like her insecurity was like almost this like weird little quirky personality trait of the, you know, as opposed to something that was deeply rooted within her. And I think there are these moments when she speaks, and it's, I think that's what has always frustrated me about this, is because there are these like really deep moments when she's sitting on the bed and she's talking to Buffy and she's like, why wouldn't she want to be this, you know? And you realize that Willow's narrative about herself was not nearly as warm and loving as our narrative about Willow was, right? Like Willow was, you know, meek and she didn't stand up for herself and people walked all over her. And like, she just desperately wants to be able to, like, I think, give as good as she, you know, give, you know, like punch back or fight back, but she's not in her nature. So she doesn't know how. And so when she does, like, it almost like she goes too far because she's like, she's not really, that's not in her nature. So like, that's why I think some of the, like, the dialogue in the magic shop when her and Buffy are fighting feels so weird, because it's like, that's not really what Willow sounds like. Mm-hmm. That's not really like how Willow would talk, but it's almost like she's just trying so hard to be the powerful, tough girl that she thinks the magic should make her be. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's always really painful when I watch it, because I'm like, I just want her to be Sweet Willow, but she obviously kind of hates Sweet Willow.
Yeah, and the show's been playing with that for a while. I mean, you know, we talked all the time, like Jenny and I, just behind the scenes on, like, Willow may have the most jingles by the end of this show, because we start with, like you're saying, you know, water fountain, math loving Willow. And then we have Vampire Willow, which I think is the first time that the show plays with this idea of her being like, wow, look what I could be. Like, that's a possibility. That's another thing, that another option or what have you. And then, you know, we haven't fully gotten to Dark Willow, to use the show's terminology, yet in our journey. But, you know, we know that's coming. And that is exactly what you're describing, right? And I wonder, too, because as you were saying that, I'm like, is this... this whole conversation is going to be like, let's look at Willow as the character, as like a real person Willow, and like what she's going through. But then also let's take a step back into the writer's room and think about what story they were telling. And so I do wonder if there's any irresponsibility or accuracy or both in this person is misusing, in this instance, magic as the substance, and their appearance is changing, and the way they talk is changing, and the way they look is changing.
Yeah, like, and like, let's talk about this, you know, like getting darker, right? Like, oh, yeah. Now look at how her dark her hair is, and look at how dark her lips are, and like, ooh, you could tell she's bad because physically we are making her dark, right? Like, and that in and of itself has those, like, the like racial undertones of that are alarming. And then, you know, I think it's this thing like doppelganger Willow, right? That's the fun version of what happens, right? Willow gets to be bad, but she's just like sassy, and like, you know, she wears a bustier that's made out of leather. And it's kind of like when Buffy and Spike in the one where they Willow's magic,
something blue,
when Willow's, you know, again, messes with magic and, you know, like just takes everything over. That was fun. That was fun. Buffy Spike kissing. And then we get like what happens when real Buffy Spike kissing happens. And it's not like, it's not going.
We've already lost a house. So
yeah, right. Like, they're just knocking, you know, like they're just taking out city blocks and bad.
I wonder if there's something from a narrative story creation perspective, and this may be a tick in the less responsible column for what we're talking about today, but I wonder if a big part of leaning into these changes in appearance for Willow as her behavior is changing is in part to make the show's job easier when Willow swings back around. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
we talk about Angel and Angelus like they're two different people, and really the main difference is eyeliner and like more velvet, I guess. But with Willow, the same kind of vibe, like she takes this very severe wardrobe alternate path. And then when she comes back to herself, she comes back to looking more like she looked before this detour.
Yeah.
I loved your parallel between Willow's midriff equals Angelus's eyeliner, like in this story. But I think that the reason, too, that not that there's not complicated things to talk about with Angel and Angelus and what have you, but like Angel doesn't know how to button his shirt and Angelus doesn't know how to button his shirt. You know, they both struggle with buttoning shirts. But I think that, you know, when we're talking about the use of drugs and the stereotypes and the stigmas that are placed on that, and also communities who have been literally set up to fall into the misuse of these substances. I'm thinking specifically too of like sex workers and drugs. And so like when you're having a character go down a path of the misuse of magic, and one of the ways that you're showing that is by having her show more of her stomach, there's just like probably way too much for us to even unpack, but it does seem more irresponsible than what we see with Angelus.
It starts off, I think, making a lot of sense for Willow's character. And then for Smashed and Wrecked, I think it's like, war, what if we just did Requiem for a Dream for a couple episodes? And like, and call it a day, right? Like, and it's one of those things, right, where it's all true, but it didn't feel true to Willow's story in that moment, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think that, like, if you know someone who struggled with substances, or if you know how the family dynamics and how people who love them, like how they handle it, like I think there's nothing about the story that doesn't necessarily ring true in some way, shape, or form. For me, it was just like, it's really disconcerting because I feel like they chose to ignore the deeper emotions and like go like, let's do this trope and let's do this trope. Like, how do we make sure people know she's addicted to magic? Let's have her cry and ask for help. Let's have her go to a, you know, like, let's have her go sell her body. Like, that don't really make, like, it's like, no, we know Willow is in trouble because she loves Tara and she violated Tara's mind. Mm-hmm. Like, do we need any more proof than that Willow is struggling with, and which I think, again, is like, what does it have to look like for people to take it seriously? And then by the time they take it seriously, it's usually coded in all of these, like, ways that make people then really push back and reject, you know? I mean, even just like, they're all talking about it, and they're like, Willow's using too much magic, but never once are they like, yeah, like she wiped all of our brains for like an entire episode.
Dude.
You know?
I think it's reflective of our own inability as human beings to recognize things in the world unless they are painted in like these stereotyped ways. And right, like to your point, it's not that there aren't, it's not that there isn't truth to the experience. It's not that some people are not having these experiences. It's just that if we only see it, this reminds me, and I don't know if this parallel makes any sense, but it reminds me of some of the conversation around like understanding what it is to be trans. And like, if the narrative is only, I had a kid and they were playing with the toys of this gender and that's how I knew. Well, sure, that happens. But if that's the only story that we're seeing, then there's all these other experiences of being trans that are, well, but you played with the right toys, hard quotes, as you all I'm sure know, you know, and so then what? And so if we're not taught to recognize that wiping your girlfriend's memory of a fight is reason enough to have a conversation, then what are we doing?
Yeah. Well, and I think it's also this really big thing because like there's so much exploitation that happens when someone is using a substance and they're getting like shamed for it and they're getting like shoved out, right? And a lot of times when people are put into a situation that may resemble Rax, right? Like they usually don't have as many supports as they need, right? Like it's something that these things become, you know, like Willow was taken advantage of in that situation, right? Like it was like, she didn't know where she was going. She didn't know what he was going to do to her. He didn't explain himself.
Yeah.
He just like took. And I think there's a lot of like harm and exploitation that can occur. It's not all things that like people like are eagerly seeking out for themselves or even like mean to do or mean to have happen. And I think that sometimes it could be like this, like, yeah, did you see, this is what drugs do to you. They turn you into someone who will like sell their body. And like, besides like the judgment of sex workers that's interlaced with that, there's also this like thing that ignores that, as because we push away people who misuse substances, especially if it's a drug and it's not like alcohol, we're actually pushing them out of the support systems that they need.
There's so many problematic things about Rax since we're talking about Rack and we're talking about wrecked and racked. The an issue that really like just pops out at me is that The major reason that people might turn, like, it's like sex work is a valid job. That's a valid job and a valid way to get income. But it's also something that people turn to when there is no other way for them to get the income they need. And so I think it's just really problematic to have that just thrown in here. Like, Willow is not a character and has not been a character that has ever had financial need that we have seen or heard about. And so this is very much throwing this like sex work trope into a bin, as though anyone who is misusing a substance also has a proclivity toward sex work. It's like, you don't have to demonize sex work, and you don't have to but throwing them all in a bin together is very complicated.
It's always like, I think a lot of bad choices that like they show people making when they're using substances, it's always implied that it's because they're using the substance, and it never is like, it's stripped of all context of like other things, like, you know, like exploitation or like lack of social support and social stigma that prevents people from coming to someone and saying, I'm struggling with X, or I'm struggling, or no real treatment resources for people. And so I think it creates this, like, it's very Reefer Madness, like you're going to smoke this weed and then you're going to like shoot someone like 25 minutes later, like, which, you know.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, I think that's what bothers me too, because like she goes from like having a problem, a clear problem that has lost her girlfriend and has caused her to, you know, who she loves, and has caused her to violate her friends. And like, I just think like they could have just like done a little bit less with it and still gotten the message across.
Right. And I think that we'll probably have some similar conversations when we talk about Seeing Red, and we talk about those stories that are told. Like, why do we choose to tell the stories that we tell the way that we tell them?
I don't know if this is something that like you experience from this arc and also like in film and television at large. I kind of like am wondering if it's like when I see somebody get onto stage in a TV show or a movie and the microphone without fail feeds back no matter what's going on every single time. I feel like what we see in Wrecked, with Willow meeting Rack, returning to Rack, being reckless, lying, and endangering Dawn pretty significantly, that to me represents, right, what we would maybe commonly think of as the trope of like reaching rock bottom. And I don't know if that is an acceptable, if that's like a term that is used, it probably a term that's avoided.
And I don't think so, because I think it's really helpful for how people kind of have the narrative for their own use. And like, as we know, like for people, like having our own narrative and understanding our own narrative is like super important for healing and understanding. Mm. And so like rock bottom is a thing, right? Like, in that people will have a moment where they feel like their motivation shifts, or their desire to change shifts, or, you know, like this is no longer work, right? A clarity moment, like whatever you want to call it. I don't like rock bottom when it's advice given to the loved ones of people who may be misusing substances as something they just need to experience. There's been a lot of reckoning about what enabling is in the substance use like treatment community, because before it was like, don't enable them, don't enable them, don't enable them. And like literally enabling meant like, don't treat them with care a lot of times for lots of people, right? Like, I mean, I was told like sometimes like you just need to tell them to call the cops because their son's going to be dead, and they might better to be in jail than to be dead, right? Which is like, yeah, like better to not be dead, though there's lots of other ways we can get to that point, right? Yeah. Like this idea that like, if you know that your kid's gonna go out and steal because they're so desperate for money, for drugs, like give them $20, you know, like, I'm not saying you're like condoning their habit, but like, there's this idea that like the only way, it's still really like, and there are people in recovery who probably heard me say that, like, because like everyone's like journey is different. And I'm aware of that. And there are plenty of people who sobriety really is the option for them, is the only option, is the best option. And I'm not taking anything away from that finding rock bottom, or that like going to jail or something, wasn't someone's true journey. It's just, it doesn't have to be everyone's journey. And I think that's the piece. So for me, yeah, this idea of you have to hit rock bottom, you know, this idea of they don't want your help, you can't help them, there's nothing you could do. And like, there are some truths to that. Like, I always used to tell, like, parents when they were trying to, like, support their kids, you know, they go to these, like, elaborate things, like, I'm going to search all of their bags and I'm going to do, you know, like, and I would be like, I'm going to just explain something to you, which is that they're always going to, if they want to use, they're going to want to use more than you want to stop them. Mm-hmm. And I know you can't imagine that right now because you want to keep your kids safe with every like ounce of your being, but like you don't, if they are really in a place where that is the thing that they feel like they need to do, they're going to do something you're not going to be able to imagine. And so like, I would tell them to be less about like, do less with this, like, I'm going to search your bags, and do more about offering to let them like come, like sit in your bed and just like, you know, be in that room, you know, with you until, and they don't have to talk, right? Or like giving them that space to come to you. Or if they say like, I need to do X, like, because otherwise I'm going to do Y, like, let's go do, you know, like letting them go do X, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and thinking like not X the drug per se, but like, right. That I should clarify that. You know, like, and, but because we have this sobriety, and you see it with this Willow story, right? Like, you have to stop using magic, like cold turkey, but it's like, let's not act like magic hasn't been useful. And she, how can she stop using magic? Her best friend is a vampire slayer. She's in a magic shop. It's like, don't drink beer. But by the way, we're all going to hang out at the local sports bar all the time.
Right, like, right.
And you just need to be really strong about it. Like, it is, magic is literally embedded in everything that they do. And like,
in this analogy, like, beer is really helpful in fighting evil.
Yes, right. Like, you know, maybe where it's medieval times and the water is bad. Yeah. We need the beer.
Right. Well, and not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but this is the way this conversation is going to go. We're just going to bounce around because, you know, there's been conversation that we've had off air about this. And I would love to bring it in now of the larger arc of Willow and her relationship to magic. Right. And the fact that Willow has been using magic almost since the start of the show. Yes, she had less powers in the beginning, but magic has been there. And since we can spoil things, magic is going to be there. And so, you know, I just wonder what your thoughts are on that, because Willow, and this has to do with, you know, we can talk about access and all these things, but Willow's arc is very much that she is misusing magic. And then she is rehabilitated. Her relationship to magic is rehabilitated. And so I wonder what your take on that is in a general sense.
So like, I really like the beginning part of the Willow story, right? And then I like where it goes, right? With this, like, the magic is inside of you. Like, this isn't something that you can make go away like that. So you have to learn how to, you know, because I think like, magic is the behavior for the emotion, right? And so like, it's like, you're always going to have this option to use magic. You can never like make magic go away. So you have to learn how to cope with your emotions in a way so that, you know, in this case, magic isn't harmful, right? And so for her, it's literally like, you need to stop trying to control the world when things go badly for you, like literally, like, oh my God. And it's just like this point where like, if they understood anything about why she was doing what she was doing, like, of course, when she felt everyone's pain, she was going to be like, ha ha, let's all be dead. That'll be better.
Yeah.
No one should feel like this, because that is literally Willow's like whole thing is like, I'm so sick of pain. I'm so sick of feeling out of control. I can now do something about it. Let's do something about it. Mm-hmm. So that's why I really hate that they moved it from like, I don't know if it's metaphor or analogy, whichever one works better, to like legit direct comparison of addiction to magic. Mm-hmm. Because she should be able to use magic. Demons are attacking. Let her use magic.
Right, right.
And I think it's just partially the show did never really defines magic. Like, I feel like compared to most fantasy like things, Buffy doesn't do a lot of like deep lore into what magic is. And there's always, every once in a while, it has a cost, you know, sometimes they bring a demon back, sometimes they don't, like sometimes it's sparklies and it's fun. And sometimes it's like these deep Latin incantations. Like, there's no consistency to the magic. So I think that's also why it makes it hard. It's just whatever they need it to be in any given moment for this story.
I know, Natalie, that we're going to get to Tara and the Scoobies. I mean, not that Tara isn't a Scooby, but Tara has a very specific relationship.
Different,
But before we sort of turn that page and go there, I want to read a small segment of a listener email, because I think it relates a bit to some of these like metaphor analogy things that we've been touching on.
Yes.
This listener wrote to us and said, the show uses magic as a vehicle to show how drugs can destroy not only the addict, but the addict's entire world. I remember saying to my sponsor in Narcotics Anonymous, why can't you just hate me? It would be so much easier for you to just hate me when I relapsed after 7 months. But he didn't hate me. He kept loving me until I learned to love myself again. While his compassion didn't save the world, in capitals, to symbolize, of course, Willow and the world of her journey, he did save my world. And so this is really in relation to Xander being the one who, like, his love is essentially what saves Willow and the world.
Yeah, it's true, right? Like, I think that listener email really hits on the head. Like, right, there's so much underlying truth to this with Willow, and that this love and support is what helps people get back to a place where they feel safe. And like, when we create stigma around substance use, and we create stigma around the behaviors that people do when they use substances, so that it just adds. So if someone's already struggling with feeling unlovable or feeling bad, then they don't love themselves, or they're not loving themselves in this moment, and other people are still loving them, it can be really hard. And, you know, I think one of the things that, again, like, I like the Xander saves the world with just being Willow's support no matter what she did, right? Mm. Like, that seeing Willow as Willow versus seeing Willow as her actions in these moments when she's in extreme pain. And I think that one of the reasons I dislike the, like, addicted to magic, like, it's the magic that makes her do this, like, it really denies Willow the fact that she's just lost Tara, and like, she made an active choice, like, let her make that choice, and like, let her talk about that, you know. And like, and I think, like, you know, by the end of it, it's about like, okay, Willow's now made a lot of choices that are going to make it hard for her to come back, because she's going to feel bad about them, because she is a good person, and so we need to make sure she doesn't feel bad about them. We need to give her those supports so that our judgment and our punishment isn't this obstacle for her. I think that's like what Xander gets, and that's what Giles gets, and it's what I wish everyone who struggled with some sort of behavior that can make them feel unlovable, or that can make, like, create challenges in their life and in the lives of their loved ones, that like, people can see past the behavior to find, you know, the compassion. And I think that's what this listener is talking about with their relationship with their sponsor versus, you know, someone who was just going to say, yeah, you did crappy things and you need to feel bad about them.
Yeah. Like, Yeah. And yeah, I think it goes without saying in this conversation, and if you listen to the segment that we had Natalie on in a previous episode, we talked about this a bit, but it's like, you know, Willow, right, by the end of the series, and sort of a massive turning point is the loss of Tara, but also before the start of the season, she's lost her best friend. She's brought her best friend back to life. She's discovered that she yanked her out of heaven. There's just a lot going on. And so I say that, I think that's, we all know that, but I just want to sort of establish it in this conversation as well.
And it's obvious how much it's been weighing on Willow, because she keeps bringing it up when she's talking to Buffy. Like, I ruined it for you because Willow brought you back with magic, right? Like, she knows she's hurting people, and she doesn't know what else to do. Nobody was talking to each other. No one was offering that support because everyone else was dealing with their stuff, you know, and no one wanted to like stop and do that, you know, time. And Tara tried, but, you know, one person can't do it all, you know.
Today's episode is brought to you by Regal Cinemas. If you're anything like me, you deeply enjoy going to the movies. Going to the movies is probably among my top three all-time activities. I love seeing films on the big screen. I also love being around other people who are watching the same movie with me at the same time. And of course, I love eating giant buckets of popcorn. If you feel the same and you like going to the theater, Regal Unlimited is something that just makes sense. Regal Unlimited is the all-you-can-watch movie subscription pass. It pays for itself in 2 movie visits. You can see any standard 2D movie anytime, no blackout dates, no restrictions. When you want to watch a movie in 4DX or IMAX or RPX or ScreenX, there's so many ways to watch movies these days, your Regal Unlimited membership gets you into those premium experiences at a reduced cost. And with Regal Unlimited, you don't only save money on the tickets, you will also save on your snacks. And as previously mentioned, I love snacks. The only thing that can make me love a snack more is saving money on buying a snack. Members get 10% off of all non-alcoholic concession items with membership. Regal Unlimited, all you can watch movie subscription pass. It pays for itself in 2 visits. So if you're planning to see 2 movies this month, join Regal Unlimited and sign up now. You can sign up in the Regal app or on regmovies.com/unlimited. Sign up for Regal Unlimited using code BUFFERING and earn 10% off your 3-month subscription. Please let us know about all of the movies you see and how the popcorn is.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for 2 women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm curious, and I'm sure Kristen is curious too, what is your read on the way we see Tara kind of navigate Willow's treatment of Tara, Tara's reaction to that treatment, their separation, their reunion?
Yeah, I think she does as good a job as anyone can do, right? Like she struggles sometimes to say what she's really upset about, but who wouldn't? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think she sets boundaries and she tries. Tara does what she can to support someone she loves without, but also realizing that she can't say like, okay, and that includes like violating my boundaries, right? Like I can support you, but if you're going to like literally do magic on me, if I'm going to be hanging around, I'm going to have to leave, right? Because that is traumatizing me in a way that's not healthy for me. And I think that's the hard piece, because it's like to help someone, to support someone doesn't mean like you literally have to give them the exact relationship with you that they want, but it doesn't mean you could do it in other ways, right? You know, and she's there for Dawn as much as anyone is there for Dawn.
Maybe way more than anybody else is there for Dawn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right?
Okay. So as of where we are right now, Giles has just fucked off to England. After, you know, noting that he had serious concerns about the amount and kinds of magic that Willow's using. I don't know. Can you talk about how you see Giles's relationship to Willow and the ways in which she is misusing magic and the ways in which he is responding and trying to intervene?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's clear, right? Like Giles of all of them has like a deeper history with magic, bad and good, right? Like, you know, he raised the demon, people died. Ethan Rain keeps popping up every once in a while. Like, and so
miss you, buddy.
The way Giles treats her when he comes back and then he takes her to England is very much the Giles Willow relationship, right? Like, and she did respect him and she did love Giles. That relationship makes sense. It's the him leaving, knowing that she's like delving into really deep things, and him never once being like, hi, do you remember that demon guy that came and found me? Like, magic has cost. Magic can make you feel powerful. even, you know, like, even if you think you're doing it for something good. Like, I just wish at some point someone would have said to Willow, like, I get that you think that this is helping people, but you're, but maybe it's not. Like, maybe you're just trying to refuse to accept, like, what is.
It's complicated too, because Giles, right, has a lived experience of using magic in a way that not only harmed but killed somebody. He has the history, and obviously his relationship to it is healthy. We see his relationship to magic as one that is healthy throughout pretty much the whole show. But he also is traumatized in other ways. And so, you know, I think that if Giles was just this person who had had this relationship with magic and was just talking to Willow about that, we might see something different. But I, not to like at all make an excuse for what Giles decides to do, but I do think that for Giles, there's this massive amount of trauma as well. And that it might be even more upsetting to him that he can't figure out the way to get through to Willow, because he truly, more than anyone, knows what the dangers are of this and how serious it is. And so if you know that on the level that Giles knows it, and you can't figure out a way to get through to this person who doesn't yet know it, I have to imagine that that is terrifying.
Absolutely. And I think, like, the thing is like, he does know what to do with her when it gets really bad, right? Like, he knows how to bring her back. He has a plan. He understands that, like, she's forgetting, you know, like, he understands that her rage is, like, this is coming from the loss of Tara, right? Like, he knows instinctively, like, something really bad happened to Willow, otherwise she wouldn't have done this. Like, and so, like, he seems to understand that. And I, you know, and then he gives her the, like, when she's on the recovery side, right? He, which we could talk about, like, she gets the, like, good treatment, right? She doesn't go to jail. She doesn't get punished. She gets to go to a coven. Learn how to use magic appropriately. And like, it's, even though, like, they're still, like, worried about her, you know, and scared of her a little bit, because, like, it's with, and Giles is there for her and he's supportive without, like, absolving her of, like, what she did. And I just, like, wish, like, Giles would have left, because it was like, I'm a little worried about Willow. I'm going back to England. We need to figure this out.
Right.
And, like, just give him another reason to go. And, like, I think it makes more sense. Like, and then he's back and he's ready to help Willow. I was too late. Here's all the good magic.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
I was on a quest to gather all of the tools he needed. I was helping.
I'm so sorry. Yeah.
But it's interesting when you think about, I don't know, like, my lived experience is that if there is trauma that is in no way related to me or that I'm not also experiencing, I have so many tools and the ability to engage with it. Like, the loss of Tara, not that Giles isn't impacted by the loss of Tara. Of course he is. But but that, not like the loss of Buffy. The loss of Buffy for Willow and Giles, I think, has equal resonance, and bringing her back has equal resonance. And so I do wonder too if, like, his proximity to it makes him completely incapable of helping her through the trauma, because it's also his, you know, whereas Tara's is not as much.
Yeah. And I think, like we said before, like, everyone's just traumatized. Like, they've been fighting demons for 6 years. People are dying. Like, there's loss. There's, and so, like, it makes sense that it all kind of comes to a head. It's just has been, you know, it's frustrating for us to watch when we're like, just sit down and talk to each other.
Yeah. You're not a little easier, I guess, for us.
Or just, like, leave everybody alone in a room with Anya and Spike for, like, 20 minutes. Yeah. Just give them, like, 20 minutes of those two.
Call Cordelia back. Throw her in the mix, too, you know?
Right?
Just, yes. Yeah.
We'll get Spike's emotional intelligence, and then we'll get Anya's, like, clear, logical, rational, like, response to things, and, like, let's move forward.
Natalie, you touched on it, and that's the place that I know we want to go. The fact that Willow, and I'm gonna read Alba's words here, because Alba has been a huge part of the production of this episode. And you know, Alba said, Willow has been held accountable by her community in this, not yet by Wrecked, but we're talking the whole season, right? She is held accountable. But she never has to, and this is what you were mentioning, deal with the consequences of her addiction in the, quote, real world. She's able to return to school in season 7 without having to jump through any hoops. She never has to deal with finding work or having to worry about housing, food, basic necessities. And that's what you're talking about, too, of, like, she's flown to England and she's immersed in this healthy coven relationship to magic, and like how viewing Willow as somebody with privilege who is misusing magic is, I think, really important. So I will let you speak a bit on that.
Yeah, I mean, like, the reality is, like, we know, like, people get different treatment. We know that basically white people use drugs as much as any other identity, yet they're arrested less often. They have access to treatment more often. And so there is this piece, right? There isn't this, like, implied criminality, immediate implied criminality when you talk about substance use. And we see how society reacts differently when we're talking about substance use that's coded as something that happens like in the inner cities versus like, you know, in a rural area. Mm-hmm. So we talk about, you know, the crack cocaine usage, you know, in the 80s versus the way we responded to the, you know, the opioid epidemic. And like, even if you just like, if you Google like crack epidemic versus opioid epidemic, like the pictures that pop up are like startling, like, you know, criminalization of Black bodies in one versus people who are treated with sympathy and like how we do that. And I think like there is so much privilege in Willow's story because really she does something with her, with especially with the way they project her, like, you know, like the addiction storyline, you know, air quotes, like that, like she has no contact with law enforcement or anything like that. And so this idea that like she's able to kind of like go through this journey without outside societal forces like the criminal justice system or something like that pushing in on her, like shows that like it's a rough journey in and of itself, let alone when you have other people jumping in to create even more obstacles and to tell you you have to be sober and you have to go to jail and you know, and like, yeah, it's just, it's completely different.
Well, yeah. And I, you mentioned this, we talked a little bit about this already. So I don't know that there's a ton more to go into, but I do think for somebody like myself, who I don't know a ton about what it is to be on parole and what the system tells people who are on parole for possession of drugs or, you know, XYZ. But it sounds, based on what you've been saying, that there is absolute, and this is not surprising in a governmental system, especially if it parallels any other governmental system in this country, that there's no nuance, that it is, this is the rule. It's probably from 1962 that the rule was written down and this is what we do. But I would love to hear a little more on that.
It's all bullshit, right? Like, we expect people.
Period.
Right? No, it's bullshit. So like, you get this dynamic. And I remember I would get so frustrated, especially when I first started working in the field, because I would be like, they're expecting people to do things that I can't do. And I'm not struggling with like, dependency to heroin or like, you know, like, I mean, we tell people it's like, you know, we arrest them and then we say like, okay, we're going to let you out, but you have to have a job and you have to go to treatment and you can't use it all. And you have to have a place to live and you have to do all of this community service and you have to meet your probation officer. And if you fuck up any way, shape or form, you're going back to jail and then you're going to get a violation on your record, which means that you're not going to be able to get out again later. Right. Like, and it's just like, I'm looking at this and I'm like, okay, intensive outpatient programs are 12 hours a week and they operate during normal business hours, right? So like you're 9 hours or 12 hours a week, you can't work.
Right.
Plus you have to do community service. Plus like, you know, you have to find a safe place to live. They're not going to help you find a safe place to live, but you have to find one. And then, you know, the way the criminal justice system like embeds itself in treatment facilities is like really, really toxic. Because it's hard because you want to help them, but you also are never 100%. It's really hard to help them when you also have someone else that they're like, they have to answer to. So like they get told to go to treatment and then they are also told, well, you have to sign a release because they're going to be drug testing you and they need to let us know if you fail a drug test, right? Because this is court ordered treatment, which means it's not really your treatment. Like we're going to be looking in on it at all fucking times, you know, or we create this like transitional housing for people because they need it. They need a safe place. Maybe they need a sober house. Maybe they don't have anywhere to go, but a lot of them are on probation, which means that the probation officer is going to demand that if they live in transitional housing, they want you to do drug screens. And there needs to be like requirements that they, by the way, they have to go to NA meetings. Doesn't matter if these NA meetings are filled with a whole bunch of people who are actively still fucking using, right? Like it makes no sense. It's obstacles for obstacles' sake. And it could be really, it's really frustrating. And as long as drugs are criminalized, you're not going to be able to pull treatment away from the criminal justice system the way it really should be for any other system. Right. That's my rant.
No, it's but it's so important because it's, and it's also that, like, tying it back to what we're saying about Willow doesn't set a foot in that system that is so much because of her privilege. And that if people with privilege were, I mean, that wouldn't happen, right? Because the system exists specifically because it is people without privilege that are in the system. But if people with privilege were in that system, the system would not be the way that it is at all. And so anyway, it was your rant. I didn't mean to rant over it, but I'm angry too.
But it's fucking layered, right? Like, you arrest the rich college kid driving home from, like, the Robert Taylor homes in Chicago, and you're like, where did you get the drugs? Like, we'll give you probation if you tell us where you got the drugs, so we can go in there and we can go put somebody who's probably Black away for like 20 years. Mm-hmm. And you get to be on probation and we're, you know, like, and so there's like privilege within the system of even being arrested, right? Yeah. Like, who gets released on probation? Who gets dealing charges versus who doesn't? Like, you know, who's viewed as the victim? Like, dealers being charged for overdoses, for, you know, like homicide charges. Like, the odds are most people are buying their drugs from someone else who they know who uses, right. You know, right. Like. It just really creates it's just toxic. It's toxic all the way down.
Something I'm really interested in is that, like, Buffy seems to be working overtime to equate what she is up to with Spike, or what she doesn't want to be up to with Spike, or what she really wants to be up to with Spike, but, like, doesn't want to want it with what's going on with Willow. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm curious how that strikes you within the context of the show.
So, I mean, it's messy, but it's like, Buffy's in pain and she's doing something that she knows isn't necessarily good, but she knows makes her feel better in the moment, even if it makes her feel bad later on, or even if it creates more problems for herself. Like, and I mean, I think Buffy's got a lot of, like, she's stigmatizing her own behavior, right? Like, I'm dirty, I'm having sex with this, like, evil vampire, what's wrong? Right, like, so Buffy's stigmatizing herself. She's not offering Willow that space and that graciousness to say, like, hey, like, people are worried about your magic. I think something else is going on. I think you're struggling because I'm struggling and I know I'm doing things that feel like that aren't healthy for me too. But instead she's just like projecting, like she's not using it to connect to Willow. And she tries, like she sits on the bed and she starts to have that conversation. Right. And then Amy walks out of the bathroom and that's all blown to hell. But then you see how fast, like all of a sudden, like that projection, like it turns to like anger. When she really is faced with like what's going on with Willow and how it makes her feel. And she gets very stigmatizing with Willow. But I also think that's how she's probably talking to herself too, internally.
Oh yeah.
Which I think is just, you know, we're taught shame and stigma. We're taught, you know, we're taught that like tough love and things like that are things that we all need to go through. We're taught that we need a rock bottom. And so I think it makes sense when people talk to other people the way they also maybe talk to themselves. So I think, yeah, there's a lot going on.
There's so much to talk about here. I mean, we've done a lot. We've talked about a lot.
like we've been all over the place.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's really how this arc is delivered to us, I think. You know, it is truly kind of all over the place.
It is, yeah. No, I was just saying it is. It's really, and it's one of those things because I feel like there are these moments where I'm like, that's so good. And then there are moments where I'm like, oh, just dial it back a little bit, guys. Like, we get it. We get it. It's like, we can't tell an addiction story if we don't hit all of these paths. But it's like, everyone's story looks different. And like, what if we just like, didn't feel like we had to focus on all these behaviors or all these like milestone moments to say, this is what addiction is. Instead, just said like, this is what happens when things are hard and we try to cope with them in ways that don't help us.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, and I think like taking the autonomy away from Willow sometimes was what really would bother me. Like she wanted to kill Warren. Mm. So did Dawn, you know, like So she made a choice, and that choice compounded on itself and compounded on itself. And then she, at this point, she was kind of, you got the vibe that she was like, well, I'm just going to have to be this person now. I'm mad. And like, you see these moments when like she gets at the pain and she falters and, you know, like when she's about to, you know, the bullets going through Warren and she's talking about Tara, and you could tell like she's talking to herself about Tara and what happened. And you could see her go back to the start to almost like she starts to be like, you know, a little bit more like Willow. And then she like steals herself and it's like, because she so doesn't want to deal with that kind of pain. It's right. just, she's been avoiding mm-hmm. it for so long. And it's just so hard.
The autonomy is just a really good point in general to bring up. I think that so often we're told that when we are moving through trauma, we are not ourselves. Like I hear that said all the time, like I'm not me. And it's like, well, this is still you. Like you're not you. You are just mm-hmm. you moving through trauma. And like that is echoed in what you're saying. Like Willow wanted to kill Warren. Warren is a piece of shit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not crying over him at all.
I'm not saying that pieces of shit deserve to be killed by any means, no. But like the desire to do something horrible to this person who has done the worst thing in the world to Willow and to Tara, but also mm-hmm. has done horrible things to countless women specifically
yeah
since we met him is like not a desire that is complicated to understand.
mm-hmm. No, I mean, right? Like, I mean, even at the end, like Dawn and Xander both were kind of like, you know, like and Buffy asked her about like killing people or thinking you kill someone. Like it's the killing of another human being is what I'm trying to save Willow from. I'm not trying to save Warren. Like fuck Warren.
Right.
Like, no one's going to cry for Warren per se, but like, we're trying to save Willow from doing something that since we know Willow, we know she's going to regret. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just all sad.
Yeah. It's complicated too.
Yeah. Super.
Natalie, although we could talk forever, mm-hmm. I wonder if
you probably have stuff to do.
Yeah, like one or two things to do. Yes. I know that your dogs are like really, really, really excited for you to stop talking to us and to start talking to them.
Yes.
But is there anything that you wanted to hit in this episode specifically in our conversation that we didn't bring up?
I think there's this moment where Buffy really gets it, like where they say something like there should be limits. There should be limits to what we can do or what, but Willow doesn't believe that. And I was like, there it is. That's it. That's it. Willow believes that if you can, like, why would you live like this if you don't have to? Like, why would you live in this pain? Why would you live in this rejection? Why would you live in this insecurity if you don't have to? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really this important piece. And I feel like it's there in threads. And I think it's underlying, I think it just sometimes gets lost in the like really direct relational, like I'm so juiced or whatever kind of thing that they say, that like Willow really just, why do I have this power if I can't make things better? But also like what Willow thinks better is not feeling pain and not having bad things happen. And right. And that's not unnormal. Like a lot of us would do. I mean, like, that's why there's like things about like the three wishes and the monkeys, you know, like we always think, be careful what you wish for. And I think the whole point of the season six, right, is like, and they tell Buffy that too. Like, it's like living is hard and the easy way doesn't get you where you want to go. Like the way you think it does.
The way you think is the easy way is never the easy way. It looks like a bejeweled path until you get to the bend and in the path and you're like, where the fuck did the bejewels go, you know?
Yeah, right. Like it's like you're still living, like you know, and so I think that's the piece. And like that's what happens, like bad things happen to us, we lose people, or we have our life takes a turn that we didn't expect and we have to find out mm-hmm. how to adjust who we are in light of that new information. And yeah. I think for Willow, you know, she was going on kind of this run, right? Like she went to college, she was smart, and then she, you know, she was a Wicca, and then she, you know, she met Tara, and like, oh, okay, this is it. Like I, you know, like I'm a lesbian and this is great and I love it and I am me and I am fully me and I am ready for this. And And then, like, life intrudes on her again, right? With Buffy dying and, like, but now she has power. Mm-hmm. And what does she do with that? Like, you know, she's not just, like, upset trying to cast little spells. You know, she's, like, legit has power.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I mean, that's a true, I think that that's something that the show does correctly, at least in my experience, is I don't feel that anyone set me up, and nor any of the people I talk with the ability to understand that life would just keep coming at you, you know, like that was not the way. And I don't know if that conversation is changing for people who are young now. Maybe their parents are having different conversations with them. Maybe the media is telling some stories that are a little bit different. But like, certainly it was only when life kept coming back around to punch me in the face that I was like, oh, this is just it. Okay. It's like, it's real good and it's real bad. And both of those things are true. It's not, it's never going to be just like sparkles and bubblegum. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and I guess when you're literally fighting demons, why wouldn't you fight the metaphorical ones too? why can't I do that? Yeah. I just make it go poof.
Yeah.
We literally
That's true. That's go true. Poof
all the time. Yeah. It's literally what we do.
They like break the fourth wall. They're like, the writers let us kill all the other demons.
Why can't we kill our inner turmoil demons too?
The fuck?
Not there. How dare you?
Natalie, I have a feeling that our listeners will have a lot of feedback and questions and what have you. So I wouldn't be surprised to have another conversation with you in the future or to bring you into the fold in some other ways. But just can't thank you enough for being here to help us unpack all that is Willow and magic.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the one last thing I would like, thank you so much for having me on. And like, I, you know, I don't speak for everyone in the recovery community or everyone in the treatment community or the harm reduction. Like I am one person doing one thing in this like broad tapestry. And so if I miss, if you feel like I miss like represented your experience, like that wasn't my intention. And I know it's nuanced, or if I said something in a way that was a little inartful, like obviously I didn't mean to, and I apologize if I've caused any harm in that way. And I just feel like it's hard because there's so much built into talking about substance use, and it's really hard to do it, and it's really hard to struggle with it. And so I hope that I did the best I could, and that people find value in the conversation.
Yeah, and I think that, well, first of all, thank you for like being willing to have the conversation for that reason specifically too, that it is, it's not one conversation. And that's like where we tried to start as well. That like you can't, it's not like we decided like we're going to do this episode and then that's the end of it. But also, you know, Natalie, I think you approach conversations like this, like Jenny and I try to approach conversations like this, which is, let us know, you know, like I think, you know, Jenny and I are super like when we talk about Buffy and Buffy's mental health, when we do that conversation, that's going to be a very different conversation for me to have. I'm going to have a lot more to contribute about my personal experience and what have you. But I can still learn there. There's no question that I have a ton to learn here. And I don't think that anyone in this conversation thinks that they know everything there is to know. So please, you know, if you don't know our email already, it's bufferingthevampireslayer@gmail.com. And send us your emails. Send us your feedback. Positive, negative, thoughtful, questions, whatever, you know, and we will take that in and process it and continue having the conversation. So there's never an end.
No, like, and like you said, like, you know, who knows, like, if we're going to come back and, like, hear the way we're talking now, be like, and, like, honestly, like, I hope so, because that means we've probably moved even further. Like, I would love for this conversation to feel dated in some ways, too. Like, I would love that there to be, like, a whole revamped way of looking at this that makes even, like, my rant about, like, the criminal justice system come back and be like, oh, she was thinking so small then. Like, please,
totally.
Like, let me, you know, I hope I'm thinking too small.
But that's the, you know, like, I think thinking out loud is the way that you get to bigger places. Mm-hmm. Like, if we're not having the conversation at all, then we're just going to be where we are. We're never going to take a step forward from there. So hopefully this was, like, informative for much of our listenership, and maybe it sort of inspires mm-hmm. more. I know that, like, this is really a first step for myself in like learning how to have these conversations and understanding mm-hmm. them a bit better. So I think that's important, and also, you know, I'm hoping that some people feel seen and like cared for in this space.
So too, and I think it's just like the show's maturing, so I think that's why these conversations are happening. Like, the show's getting harder. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a reason I rewatched the first like 3 to 4 seasons, because they're like 90% of the time they're fun. Like, you know, and then like season 6 and 7, it's like, it's not as fun, mm-hmm. but at the same time, like, it's deeper and it's, you know.
Yeah. I think it goes without saying that you can find Natalie and the resources that we'll add to this episode in the show notes today. Truly, Natalie, thank you so much for having the conversation with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Anytime.
Have a wonderful rest of your day.
You guys
please.
Too.
And we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
Right on. Thanks so much.
No problem.
Nowadays, trends and news cycles change faster than we can blink. But there are some things that withstand the test of time. And if you're looking for a connection to something timeless, and maybe also a glimpse of life at a slower pace, I believe everyone can relate to the very human experiences explored in Jane Austen's novels. And that's where I come in. My name is Alison Larkin. I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin. I spent a lot of my childhood in the part of England where Jane Austen lived and wrote, and now that I live in the States, nothing gives me a sense of homecoming quite like narrating her books. On this show, you'll listen to award-winning narration. I'll give myself a pat on the back for that, as well as conversations with actors, writers, and other fascinating people who all share a passionate love for Jane Austen. So please join me as we embark on a wonderful journey through Jane Austen's work. Be sure to listen and subscribe to The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin, wherever you get your podcasts.